This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It's June 13th, 2018. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, Fran Storch.
Hey.
A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, you can call us at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. If you're listening to this on podcast, you can also send an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can visit and comment at Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. Going to start us out once again with Ron's Rant of the Week. This is an interesting one. Cyclist blaming headlines. Now, I caught this little piece. This kind of came, It came from Bicycling Magazine. And the statement here is, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but I just wanted to start this off. Follow enough bike news, and it won't take long for you to notice a few concerning patterns in the headlines about bike crashes. The word accident, quote unquote, appears even when the driver is clearly at fault. A cyclist's clothing or helmet choice is often mentioned, although the driver's DUI only appears in paragraph 3. And there's a constant car hit cyclist, quote unquote, refrain, which cloaks the fact that a human being was even at the wheel of the motorized vehicle. It's an issue of victim blaming that frustrates advocacy groups who say that this kind of messaging from mainstream media scares people who want to ride bikes, and it makes cycling less safe as a whole. Martha Ruskowski at People for Bikes says that there are several issues at play when it comes to cyclists blaming headlines. Chief among them is the fact that so many bike crashes are featured in the news at all. We're going to talk about this a little bit further into the show. I just wanted to bring that to up to headline here. On a positive side, the laws are changing and cyclists are starting to get better recognition, but we have a long way to go. But we are starting to get more and more recognition out there. There are more bicycle organizations that have emerged. A lot of towns are starting to become bike-friendly or are in the process of becoming bike-friendly. So on a positive side, things are changing. Things are starting to look a little bit better, which is nice to see. The maintenance minute this week, this is a good one. Are you blinking or are you not? That's my question. That means if you are riding out on the road and you are riding with traffic or you are traffic, do you use a blinky on your bike? Do you use a flashing light in the back? Do you use a flashing light in the front? I have just started using a flashing light in the front because I started doing some research on this and I realized that the flashing light in the front is, it's kind of a good idea when you think about it. And then I was recognizing a number of riders as I was out riding my bicycle on the road that were starting to use them also. And you really can see them from a long way. So it's not like a car, I mean... I tried my car and I have my headlights on and people don't see me. Fran and I had a really nifty little close call last weekend because someone just looked right at me and pulled out right in front of me. And that's with driver's headlights on, the whole deal. So on your bicycle, you are less seen than you are when you're driving a motorized vehicle. Now, so what do you do to combat that? And you put one of those little flashing beacons on the front of your bike. And you can be seen for, you know, at least a quarter mile or more away. So it really helps. And I'm starting to get into the practice of, okay, got to remember to turn on my flashy light in the front as well as the flashy light in the back. I'm not as thrilled with the ones in the back, but, you know, they're because, especially if you're on a group ride, because then everybody's got these blinkies all over the place. And, you know, I know it's great for letting the cars see you as they're coming up behind, but it gets a little annoying on the ride. But that's just a personal thing, and it really is smarter to have it going on in the back and on the front. So are you blinking or are you not? You can answer that question on my Facebook page, Bicycle Talk. I would love to hear your answer, so please do. Okay, this brings me back 2 years. Okay. June 7th, 2016. Fran, do you remember what happened on June 7th, 2016? Okay, that's a no. Something very important happened. Sad and important. It was in Kalamazoo. There were a number of riders that were out on a bicycle ride, and they called themselves the Chain Gang. They're a group of local cyclists that met every Tuesday night to go for a ride. They were safe riders. They were all different ages. And unfortunately, they had a very, very bad encounter. And five of them were killed in the process of that. There were nine total. And the five deceased riders are and will remain Suzanne Sippel, Melissa Ann Fevick-Hughes, Debbie Bradley, Fred Antone, Tony Nelson, and Lorenz Larry Pollock. Ages ranging anywhere from 42 to 74 years of age. There were also other riders that were seriously injured. Paul Goebel, Sheila Jeske, Paul Runnels, Jennifer Johnson. So anyway, what happened is a driver of a car, of a pickup truck, Charles Pickett Jr., was driving down the road, and he was not 100%. He had a lot of pills in him. He was not able to navigate the vehicle very well, and he just ran them all over with his pickup truck to the point where he actually disabled the pickup truck. That's how bad it was. And he killed a bunch of riders. So it was the biggest disaster they'd seen in Kalamazoo ever, and it was really not a good thing. And why am I bringing this up? I'm bringing this up because 2 years later, the driver in the Kalamazoo crash was sentenced to 40 years in prison. Charles Pickett Jr. will be at least 90 years old before he's eligible for release. So it's tough. You know, he was high on painkillers and muscle relaxers. He veered into the shoulder of the road, hitting the cyclist from behind at nearly 60 miles per hour. So it's been called the deadliest car bike crash in U.S. history. The violent and tragic story seemed to come to a close Monday when a judge sentenced Pickett, age 52, to more than 40 years in prison. So anyway, he gave Pickett 35 to 55 years for each of the five counts of second-degree murder he had faced for his role in the crash. He also received 8 to 12 years for each of the five counts of driving while intoxicated, causing death, 3 to 5 years for four counts of driving while intoxicated, causing serious injury. It goes on and on and on. This guy had a history. He probably never should have been behind the wheel of a vehicle. It's very unfortunate. You know what he should have been doing? They should have taken his license away. He should have been riding a bicycle. But anyway, the sad part about it is that we lost some really, really good people. They were strong people in their communities. Everyone liked them, obviously. They had families. They had friends. And they're no longer with us. But what did end up happening is this person was finally sentenced for what he did. There was a very interesting video online showing one of the daughters of one of the people who she had just graduated from high school 5 days earlier, and then her mom was killed. And it was a very touching video, and she... you know, it really, moments before his sentencing, Pickett gave a tearful apology to his victims and their family. He said, I'm very sorry. I wish this tragedy had never happened. There's nothing I can do to take it back. I'll live with this the rest of my life. I would give my life for the people that got murdered or killed or maimed and everything else. I just want to say I'm sorry. So he was remorseful. You know, we'll give him that. Obviously, he was not completely in control of himself because of what was going on inside of his body at the time. It's just really sad story. But, you know, I just want to bring it up because it's something that we have to remember. It's something that we have to always be aware of when we're out riding our bicycles on the road, that we could run into a situation like this. And it's, you know, it's tragic. So just be careful out there, and let's hope that if you are the driver of a motorized vehicle or doing anything else that requires responsibility, that you're not using lots of pills and things and alcohol and anything else that's going to make it so you can't navigate your vehicle or your life. So let's keep that in mind. So moving forward on this, we're going to talk a little bit more about this, what I mentioned earlier about the cyclist blaming headlines. And I had mentioned this in my rant that, you know, you follow enough the bike moves and it won't take you long to notice that there's some concerning patterns in the headlines about bike crashes. And, you know, I think it makes good news. I don't know why it makes good news, but somehow, some way, when, you know, you get a bicyclist struck, killed by car near Palo Alto from CBS San Francisco. Why is this statement bad? This is typical, a very typical headline about a bike crash from this one, from this week alone. But where's the motorist in the headline? Was the car driving itself? Again, there it is. Better headline for the news story. And this is for you media people that are out there, if you might be listening to this. I just want you to just think about the delivery of the way you deliver your news from in the future. Instead of having it be bicyclist struck, killed by car near Palo Alto, try driver kills cyclist near Palo Alto. That way, now you're putting a human being behind the wheel of the car. Okay, the driver killed the cyclist, not the car. The driver did. So we got to humanize this, and we really want this to make an impact here. So I wanted to bring this up today because I thought this was really good. I was doing some reading, and I just thought this really made sense.
Don't say hit by a car. Say hit by a careless driver.
Hit by careless driver. That's another way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Humanize both parties. Okay, humanize both parties here. So it becomes a little, it's a better impact that way. It really is.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, well, the car did it. Well, you know, no, the person driving the car did it.
Yeah, I don't really like it when people say, my father was hit by a truck. My father was killed by a man.
Driving a truck.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. There's a better definition there.
Right,
and
yeah.
And that's truly it. And this is the way, if you take a look at any cyclist or pedestrian-oriented crashes that are out there, they all are stated the same way. And I don't know why the journalists do this. I don't have any idea why this is the way it's written. But I, of course, have, you know, conspiracy theories about it, but I won't get into that right now.
Well, it's a car industry. Who's paying for the journalists?
The car industry is paying for the journalists.
And
if you flip on the TV and you're watching something on TV, let's say your TV news, there's a really good chance in that half-hour TV news that there's going to be a car ad.
Sponsored by cars. Oh,
yeah. A car ad. So the irresponsibility is not really as much in the journalist as it is in the automobile companies that are influencing the journalists. So there's a little shout-out. You know, it can be so easily done. So here's another one. This is from CBC News. Patricia Keenan. Kelowna cyclist.
Kelowna.
Thank you. Cyclist mourned after fatal crash into car door. Okay. Why is that bad? If you read the text of the article.
Somebody open the frickin' door.
Right. It takes a human being to open the car door. Car doors don't open by themselves yet. I can hardly wait for that to come to our lives, but
some of the vans, they do. You can press a button.
Well, yeah, but you know what the vans do when they open up their doors?
They slide and they open very slowly. Yes.
You know, and they don't swing out.
They don't. That is true.
Maybe that's a new idea. Maybe we should have driver's doors that don't swing out anymore.
We have pocket doors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, why is this bad? If you read the text of the article, it's clear that Keenan was actually killed when the car driver opened his or her car door into the cyclist path, which is illegal in most places and puts the driver at fault. But to read the headline, you would think she rode her bike directly into the parked car where there was no second party involved at all. It's a tragedy, and an unintentional one for sure. But if we expect to raise awareness about the dangers of opening a car door without checking for cyclists, absolving drivers of any guilt in Keenan's death is not the way to do it. This just makes, this is like common sense. A better headline for this news story. Ready? Patricia Keenan, Kelowna cyclist. Oh, yeah. Okay. Mourned after being fatally struck by a driver's car door. That's it, driver's car door. Very quick and easy way to rephrase it so it looks better. And it's more truthful. That's really what it comes down to. Okay, now this is from Newtown, Pennsylvania. Cyclist lucky to be alive, quote unquote, after River Road accident. And that was quoted by police. Why it's bad. Here's an interesting one. The headline makes it seem as like if anyone is at fault in this incident, it's likely the cyclist. But midway through the article, this sentence appears. The cyclist was not at fault, and the driver, who has not been identified, was solely responsible for the accident, police said. If the driver was solely responsible, and in this case, driving with a suspended license, how was this an accident? Just another reason we support the use of crash not accident in headlines. Okay? So, these are not accidents. These are crashes. It's not an accident that someone opens a car door in front of you. It's not an accident that they run you over. It's more of an incident. It's more of a crash. So, if we termed everything that way, then it just makes no sense. So, a better headline for this news story: cyclist seriously injured in River Road crash. Driver will face charges. Journalists, tell the news. Don't bury it. Don't bury it three paragraphs in. Don't bury it until the very end. Let people know what's going on here, because it's a consequence. You'll be able to hear this, and you'll be able to see that there was a consequence to what happened here. This person was hurt. This person was injured. This person was killed, and there are consequences for it because another person did this. And that's my point that I'm trying to make here.
And that if people hear that, they might be more inclined to be careful when they see cyclists on the road.
My point exactly. And that's it. You got to be careful. You got to be careful. You got to be careful anyway. But, you know, we are, as cyclists and pedestrians, we are what is termed a vulnerable user. That's what we are out there on the road. We don't have the safety and protection of 4,000 to 6,000 pounds wrapped around us of metal that will protect us in case of a, I'm going to say it, crash, not accident. Okay? So here you go. This is from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Good old Minneapolis, too. Minneapolis is like the bike capital of the world here right now. Of the U.S. at least. Bicyclist fatally run over was new to Minneapolis. Careful about bike safety. That was what they said. Why it's bad. The focus on the cyclist safety in the headline and throughout the article makes it clear that this was one of the good ones. Another piece on the same incident chose the same tack, but using the headline, "Bicyclist killed on Franklin Avenue wore helmet, lights, just moved to Minneapolis." But why can't we start from the understanding that cyclists don't deserve to be hit by drunk drivers, even if they're not wearing helmets or carrying lights? A better headline for this news story: drunk driver arrested after striking and killing cyclist. Now we have directly pointed a finger at why this happened and that it was a person who was drunk when they did it. So, you know, it's just a really, really simple way of rephrasing. I've got one more here. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Let's see here. Deplane woman, 66, dies in bicycle collides with car in Aurora. Why it's bad? The headline implies that her bicycle struck an immobile vehicle by use of bicycle before car. But the cyclist was riding with a group of cyclists on a trail when the driver hit her with a car at a street crossing. The use of collision is common in headlines about crashes between two cars. But if a motorist hits a pedestrian, would you frame it that the pedestrian collided, or is it, would you phrase it they're colliding with a moving car? The forces are too dissimilar. In this case, hit by car seems more accurate and less cyclist blaming. A better headline for the news story. Deplane cyclist 66 struck and killed by car in Aurora.
Just car driver.
By car driver. Car driver in Aurora. Exactly. Yeah. Much better way to put it. Because we're not identifying motorized vehicles as people. And they are people. If you're driving a motorized vehicle, you're a person.
Unless there's a person in there.
Unless you're in one of these new self-driving cars, which I shudder to think that we're all going to be driving around in sometime in the near future.
Yeah.
Because they have their own list of problems, and I hope they get that all figured out before it becomes a normal thing that we are now going to have to be subjected to. Boy, that tells me even more now that I just want to ride my bike. At least I've got control of what I'm doing. But and maybe that's another good reason to ride a bike if you're you know stuck with a self-driving car now. Anyway, So the point here is that the headlines are cyclist blaming headlines, and it's not. Many times, it's not the cyclist's fault, and especially in cases of people who are under the influence of drugs and or alcohol, and it's, you know, there's, and or, you know, there's also some really malicious attacks out there, too, which is another problem. You have road rage, and you have problems like that. So
people who intentionally endanger cyclists,
yeah.
You know, they do things as yucky. I don't know how to say it. It's not because it's not benign. It's bad for the environment. But, you know, trucks that decide to coal roll cyclists.
Yep.
And then getting buzzed, which is really scary, because if you get buzzed, you could fall, and you could fall either direction. And
well,
it's really dangerous.
You could get buzzed close enough and freaked out enough that you fall into the vehicle.
That's right.
And then you're going to be struck by that vehicle.
Right.
And that's a really, really big problem. Really huge problem. Yeah, it's not funny to fool around with your car. It really isn't.
No.
Don't fool around with your car. Don't fool around with other people's lives.
And it's against, the buzzing is against the law.
It is
three
against
feet.
The law. 3 feet. Absolutely. 3 feet. And that is becoming the norm in almost all the states
yes,
now. It's
the
getting
three
better.
Feet rule. Mm-hmm.
I think even Montana is up for that one again.
Yeah.
We'll see if that passes through. We'll have to call them again and see how they're making out with our good senator out there. Anyway, this it just sets a tone. And let's try to, you know, if you know someone who is a journalist in your area who is reporting like this and might have, you know, said something like this. If you know somebody who's, you know, a local radio personality who talks the news, or if someone is writing for the local newspaper or the local weekly that comes out, you know, just have a conversation with them and say, hey, you know, I heard this thing on Bicycle Talk. It's kind of an interesting point, and I'd like to bring it up with you. Can we have a discussion? Very simple. You have the discussion. You explain exactly that how this all works. And quite honestly, a shout out to law enforcement. It's unfortunate that the way that a lot of this is documented afterwards is documented incorrectly by law enforcement. And the journalists are the ones, they get the information from law enforcement. Law enforcement states it with the idea that the vehicle doesn't have an owner and until it's deep into the investigation. And then, therefore, the journalist just relays the information that they're reading from the quote-unquote crash investigation. So anyway, what happens if you have an accident, okay, and the police fail to respond? So this can happen. This is a problem. And there's a few different things you want to do. But let's start first with, this is from John Dugan, who's a Seattle-based lawyer and an avid cyclist. So no matter how mild you think it might be, Dugan recommends calling the police before the event of an accident. If a police report is filed based on the information gathered at the scene. The story can't change later on if you need to submit an insurance claim. In addition, it's important that you obtain the vehicle driver's insurance information, address, phone number, and license plate number. If there are witnesses on the scene, get their names and phone numbers as well. As with vehicle-on-vehicle accidents, don't admit fault and don't minimize your injuries or your bike damage. There's no reason to. And then here's the quote here. The reason you exchange information is to protect yourself, Dugan said. My general thinking is always get the police involved. I've had incidents where everything seems great at the scene. Then the story changes once everybody gets home. So anyway, that is from a cyclist and a lawyer who gives us some great, great advice here. What happens if the police don't respond? First step in any traffic accident situation would be to contact local police and have them write up a report. While many accident victims are tempted to forego this crucial step, it's essential to resist this urge. Many times the at-fault party accepts fault immediately following the accident, only to change the story once they speak to their insurance provider or when they're in a courtroom setting. Without a police report that confirms the true story, innocent victims are frequently left with only their word in defending the position. Further complicating the issue is the fact that time and time again, the police department, especially busy metropolitan areas such as Los Angeles, they simply refused to come out to the scene of the accident. In fact, Ted Rogers of Biking in LA recently reported on the story of Melanie Friedland, which is one of the most egregious examples of police inactivity we've ever seen. Whether this is due to police indifference or general lack of resources or simple police bureaucracy, the fact remains accident victims are sometimes left dealing with the repercussions without the benefit of a police involvement. This can be especially crippling for victims that are left with thousands of dollars worth of medical and property damage bills. Therefore, in light of Mr. Rogers' report, the following is a list of additional measures that you could be taking after an accident that could protect your rights following an accident. Number one, witnesses can be your best friend. Other than the police report, independent witnesses are the most credible pieces of evidence in proving your innocence. Look out for anybody who may have witnessed the accident. Politely ask for their information if they would be willing to provide a statement in the future. Take pictures. Sometimes the only way to demonstrate how an accident actually occurred is to reconstruct the scene of the crash. Take pictures of all the motor vehicles involved, the scene, the road, skid marks, injuries, or any other picture that might help in proving your case. That's what the police do. Look at nearby businesses. Many businesses have surveillance that not only monitor the store, but also the surrounding areas. Unfortunately, these videos are usually disposed of, sometimes only after one day. Make sure you contact these establishments to see if they have video surveillance that can be beneficial to your cause. If so, ask them to preserve the evidence. And the fourth on the list here is get a statement from the at-fault party. With the advent of the smartphone, it's almost everyone has a video camera at their disposal. Ask the at-fault party to make a statement. Individuals are far more likely to be honest immediately after the crash rather than a few days later or even a few hours later when the initial shock has subsided. So these are things that you want to do. I have to say, if you are fortunate enough to carry a phone with you that can record, that is a recording device, it is a very, very powerful weapon. And it's also a great security, obviously. If you're in trouble, you can call, you can ask for help, and you can get someone to come out and help you, whether it is that you're having an encounter with the driver of a motorized vehicle that is getting a little outrageous and you have to deal with that problem, or whether someone's injured or you're injured, you can still call for help. So carrying your phone with you is so incredibly important if you have the ability to do so. And I strongly encourage this. It truly is one of the best things that has happened over the years. I've been a lifelong cyclist. I've spent so many years on the road, and lot of those years were without any kind of communication on me because we didn't have cell phones. You know, I've ridden my bike for a long time. We didn't even have helmets that we wore back in the day. So it's, you know, things have changed and the technology is with us. And if you have the ability to afford the technology, please carry it with you because it's extremely useful. One of the things that I encourage people to do is if their phone is still functioning, because that's another thing that can happen in a bike crash is you could ruin your phone, which is a problem. But if your phone is operating, first thing you do, just flip it over to video. Just put the video on. If you're not even pointing the video camera at the scene, okay, at the driver of the vehicle or whatever it is, you're at least getting an audio recording of what's going on detail by detail. I would highly encourage the first thing you do is go over to the back of the vehicle, get the license plate and the description of the vehicle for starters, because that will give you the basic information you may need should the police have to get called in and should be called in. But if for some reason this person gets really upset with you, and this does happen, they'll get upset, they'll get out of their vehicle, they'll come out and they'll rage on you and scream at you, and then they'll hop back in their vehicle and drive off. So before that even happens, go to the back of the vehicle, get the plate number, get the description of the vehicle, and then go on from there. And don't just take a picture. Turn on your video camera. Video the whole thing. Just put it all on video because that is a much stronger argument. That way you not only get a detailed picture of the incident, but you also get a detail of the incident and the level of rage that the driver of the motorized vehicle is displaying. And you're able to show this and record this. Key point here, don't get outrageous yourself. Don't do it. Stay calm. I know it's hard to stay calm when someone just about killed you. I understand that. I know that that's a really difficult thing to do. But your best defense is not to rage back. Your best defense is to stay as calm as you can, record it. You might even warn the person that you're talking to that you are recording this and that you are sending it forward. And that I have found in most cases will take that person who is raging on you and it will bring them down a couple of notches. Some to the point where they say, "Oh, you should turn that off. You don't need to do that." And the answer to that is, "No, I'm going to keep this on. I've already told you that I'm recording it. I'm going to continue to record it, and I'd like to have a rational conversation with you about what just happened." And that's the way to handle it, the right way. And I know it's real hard when your adrenaline's pumping, and you know you're drawing blood and you're obviously hurt in some way because you had this horrible encounter with a motorized vehicle. It's really hard to be rational, but you got to try to keep your wits about you. Do the best you can to control the situation, because when you do that, you're in charge of this. They're not in charge of it. They lose all of that by hitting you or by causing you to have the accident in the first place. So you need to get on top of it. You need to become bigger than they are. And the best way to become bigger than they are is to stay quiet, calm, and rational. Explain the law. Know the laws. Do you know your bike laws? Have you looked it up lately? Have you gone to your local Department of Transportation or your DMV and look to see what the rules are? It's worth it. I've talked about this in past shows. I'll talk about it all the time. It's worth repeating until everyone gets it down to the point where if you're a cyclist and you're spending a lot of time on the road, and I especially am concerned with the people who are commuting on their bicycles because they probably have a lot more exposure to traffic because they are commuting during busy times of the day. If you are that person and you do not know the rules of the road, you do not know the laws pertaining to both motor vehicles and bicyclists, you need a refresher course. Do it. It's worth it. Take care of yourself. Take care of others. Pay attention. It's well worth doing. So know your laws so that when you do have that conversation, you can look the person in the eye and you can say, "Look, here's the deal. What I'd like to do is I'd like to talk to you about bicycle and motorized vehicle law. If you'll just give me a few minutes, let's discuss what just happened. And if there was an infraction, if it was somebody decided that they were going to use their vehicle as a weapon, bad idea, you explain to them that that's a weapon that they're driving. It is not any. It is no longer a motorized vehicle. It is no longer their precious car or their precious truck. It is now a weapon. So you need to identify the situation as it is. And if they get upset with you about you calling their vehicle a weapon, explain to them that it's 6,000 pounds and you weigh 150. Just be clean with it. Be honest with it. Let them know exactly what they're dealing with. And you know, maybe they'll understand a little bit more about what they just did and that, you know, they were being irresponsible. So record it, record it, record it. I can't say it enough. Record it. The incident that Fran and I had a couple of years ago that was a mile and a half from our house, we were almost home, involving a large pickup truck. Of course, it's always a truck. I love that. Anyway, the man who was behind the driver's seat of that vehicle was very irrational. He was very upset. He did not want us on the road.
And he went viral.
And he went viral. And he did. He did because... I looked back at Fran and said, get your phone out. And she immediately hit the recorder and I recorded. I hit the record button on my two and I was holding it up. And he even took his phone out and shook it at me, like, because I was holding my phone in his face. And he didn't like that a whole lot. But anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, we recorded it. We were able to call the state police in. We were able to have the state police go have a discussion with him about it. And that's pretty much resolved the issue at that point because, you know, he assaulted us with a deadly weapon. That's really what it comes down to here. Listen carefully. If you're having a problem with a person driving a motorized vehicle and they come at you with it in a very aggressive way, it is assault with a deadly weapon.
Is that the law or are you just saying, is that your opinion?
That's a good question. Is that the law or is that my opinion?
What crime are they actually committing? What's the name of the, like, what are they actually, like, legally, what are they doing? If somebody aggressively tries to, like, buzzes you
road
or
rage.
Coal rolls you, yeah, but, yeah, that's nice. But what's the, that's not, is that a crime? They're committing an infraction. What's the infraction?
That's a good question. Is it a crime
to use
your motorized vehicle?
So you should assault with a deadly weapon is a crime.
Right.
And it's a legal term.
Right.
I'm not sure that that's what they're doing. Like when you deliberately try to hit a cyclist with a car, that's probably an infraction. And I'm not sure what the it might be reckless endangerment. I'm not sure what it is.
You know, that's probably what it is. It's probably reckless endangerment. You're probably right about that.
We should find out exactly what it
is. We should. If you can find out, I'll just keep chatting here and you can look and see if there is an actual legal term to that. To me, it seems like it should be that way. And if I were king and I were involved with my local bicycle coalition and wanted to get some laws changed, that'd be a good one right there. That would be a really, really good one because that term just it changes things. It changes things a lot. You know, I don't know what defines first degree murder and second degree murder either. The Pickett out there in Kalamazoo, he got charged with second degree murder, not first degree murder. What's the difference? I don't really know. If anyone knows about that and you want to comment on it, you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can also put something up on the Facebook page for Bicycle Talk. I'd love to hear a legal opinion on this. And I know I've got a couple of lawyers out there that listen to me. So let's find out what that's all about. Fran's looking, too, to see if she can find anything. But in the meantime, if we find out more about it, we'll report on it next week on the show next week. I've got a little bit more that I would like to talk about today because it's June. It's the middle of June, almost the middle of June. What does that mean, Fran? Any idea what that means?
The middle of June?
Yeah, what does that mean?
It means in 2 weeks it's the Tour de France.
Yeah, see that? Now, here's a woman who has her priorities straight. Think about this. Very, very nice. Yes, Tour de France 2018. It's coming. It's real soon. I have here stage details. It's going to include the infamous Alpe d'Huez this year. And it's also going to add another thing. You're going to see a return of the Paris-Roubaix cobbles for the first time since 2015 on a 65-kilometer road stage in the Pyrenees. Organizers have chosen to add to this excitement in the 65K stage 17 by introducing grid-style start, which that will favor those highest on the general classification in a twist that could light up what would be one of the shortest stages in the race's history. So this is interesting because they're going into the cobbles, because they're because they don't want to affect the race too dramatically, and it is deep in. You're at stage 17. They decided that they were going to take and line the riders up by their current standings in the race, and which is interesting. That's so it's going to be a little different in that, in the, you know, a lot of times the riders will start and they'll be, especially the top GC people will be completely engulfed with, all their riding teammates will come around them and protect them and all. But in this case, those riders won't have the ability to do that as much because they're not in the general classification. They're further back, so they're not going to be able to do that. So they're going to line riders up by how they are placed at this time in the race. So I think it's a very, very interesting way of doing it. The start list is already starting to take shape with both Chris Froome and Tom Dumoulin listed, and they're ready for their rematch following the Giro d'Italia, which they took first and second respectively. This year's race takes place almost entirely in France with one very quick dip into Spain on stage 16 and kicking off with the Grand Deporte in the Vendée region in the west of France. The first stage, which is almost always a time trial, is not this year. It'll be Saturday, July 7th. And it's a 201-kilometer race. I am assuming it will be pancake flat because that would be the way to kind of get them going. Stage 2 is 182 kilometers. Stage 3 is a team time trial, 35-kilometer team time trial where the teams will work together. And usually they start with like 7 riders, I think, is on a team right now. Maybe it's 7 or 8 riders that are actually on a team. I can't remember. They just downsized it by one rider this year. But anyway, and I believe the way that they usually do the team time trials is they take the top 5 riders from that team is the finishing time. So If you shred your 5-man and he finishes 30 seconds behind you, that's the time you get. So it's extremely important to keep at least those last 5 riders together. And so a tactic that is used in a team time trial is to take 2 of your really, really strong riders, which you know won't be able to sustain for an extended period of time. You put them up front and let them start the pace off and really pace you out. So you've got a really hard charging, fast start, and then they'll peel off, and then the other riders will work together and try to keep it together as much as they can. Of course, it's best if you can keep them all together and finish in a really, really strong train, but that's the way it works. The fourth stage is 195 kilometers, the fifth stage being 204 kilometers, and stage 6 is when things are going to get interesting, because I think that's when we start heading into some hills. I actually have here 6 stages that could decide the 2018 Tour de France. So they got another little piece for Fran to look up too. I don't know if you can find this or not, but I meant to do it before I left the house this morning. And how many riders, or have any riders, won back-to-back Giro d'Italia Tour de France? And I don't know what the answer is there. I don't know if anyone...
Just those two?
Just those. So you win the Giro, and then you come back, and you win the Tour de France shortly after.
Okay, so just those exact just 2 in a row.
Exactly those 2 in a row.
All right.
Right. And then another thing which would be interesting to look up, and I may do this in a future show, is just how long does it take to recover from winning the Giro d'Italia or the Tour de France? That would be another interesting subject. So we'll talk about that maybe in the future. But starting out with stage six, Brest to Mur de Bretagne is a 181-kilometer stage. It will be on Thursday, July 12th. And it's, again, 181 kilometers. And it's got some interesting climbs in it. And the time trial will be out of the way, but the race is going to head north to Brittany for the first taste of the hills. The sixth stage features two ascents, one in the final 16 kilometers, including a climb to the finish line. This will provide opportunity for attacks and a first chance for GC contenders to test their legs, engage the form of their rivals. Though time differences will not be huge, a few seconds could decide who takes the race lead and a morale boost. Next one to keep your eyes on, stage nine, Arras to Roubaix, 154 kilometers. This is, so for many fans, this will be one of the biggest highlights of the 2018 race. The stage to Roubaix takes in 15 cobbled sectors, including up to 21.7 kilometers of the 154-kilometer route. That's a significant portion that could spell disaster for unprepared riders, rendered worse if the weather is wet and windy. Mechanical problems and crashes could easily see riders losing minutes and possibly spelling the end of their chances for overall victory. That stage also, just so you know, is very, very flat. It's a very, very flat stage, but there's a lot of cobble in there. So that's going to be interesting. I thought they were going to keep the cobbles out of the Tour de France after they did this a few years ago, was it 2015 or something? And it just really was, it just, I mean, it's good for the spectators. It's fun to watch that. But it really caused a lot of controversy. So anyway, stage 12, which is Thursday, July 19th. So that's Bourges-Saint-Maurice to Alpe d'Huez. Oh, yes, the Alpe d'Huez. The Alpe d'Huez is just such a classic. It's an icon in the Tour. And that one will be finishing on the Alpe d'Huez. So the final climb will be up Alpe d'Huez, which has been famed over the years as one of the true classics of the Tour de France. I believe at the bottom of the Alpe d'Huez, it starts at a little over 10% and goes for a short way. Actually, I have a friend that went over there and rode it, and he said the bottom of the Alpe d'Huez was just, it was a crusher. And he said it actually ended up, he said, the problem is once you get over that, then you've still got a long climb in front of you. So it tends to eat your legs a little bit. What you got, Fran?
So you wanted to know specifically who won first the Giro d'Italia and followed by the Tour de France in the same year. That was your question,
That's
right?
That's correct, yes.
So there's three that I could find.
Okay.
The first one was, guess what? Bernard Hinault. That would have been 1982 and 1985.
Nice.
Jacques Anquetil.
Oh, Anquetil,
and he only
yeah.
He did that in 1964.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll give you two guesses who
oh,
the last one is.
Oh, it's the man, the myth, the yeah. No longer the legend. He is just, well, he is the legend. He is now not no longer the myth, that's for sure. It's Big Eddie.
Yep, that's right.
It's the cannibal.
That's right.
And it's the cannibal.
And he did it three times, 1970, 1972, and 1974.
And that is why, folks, I don't care who you talk about in your cycling history, if you've been following bicycle racing for a really long time, there is only one really, truly wonderful, greatest cyclist that has ever lived, and that is Eddy Merckx. He just won everything. Three times. Three times he did that? That's amazing. So there you have it. Eddy Merckx, the cannibal. He's the big one. So
let me see if anybody won all three in the same year. I don't know.
That I don't think has ever happened, but you can look it up. You look it up and I'll move on here and talk a little bit more about our Alpe d'Huez stage, which is stage 12. And, it's incredibly hard to pick out the key stage in the Tour's visit to the Alps in the second week. Stages 10, 11, and 12 could all potentially lead to GC reshuffle with the featuring.
No, nobody's ever done that.
No, I didn't think so. Mm-mm. Featuring high mountains. We're picking stage 12 to the Alpe d'Huez here because any status quo between the GC riders in the preceding 2 days will be blown apart on the legendary hairpin-strewn climb, which of the contenders wouldn't want to stamp their authority of the race with a good performance on Alpe d'Huez? That's the other thing. You get points if you win Alpe d'Huez. Alpe d'Huez is just it's iconic, and it's just such a great classic climb. Next after that is Stage 17. That's that 65-kilometer race. Actually, I got that wrong earlier. I thought that was on the cobbles, and it was not on the cobbles. This is just ugly, nasty, short climbs, and it's going into the Pyrenees. They're expecting fireworks on this extraordinary short mountain stage in the Pyrenees. It's just 65K of racing, and it means it's the shortest tour stage in 30 years, but it packs in three tough climbs, including a new one at the end, Col de Portet, offering 16 kilometers of ascent at an average of 8% grade with a gravel section at the top. Well, there is a little gravel in here. If there isn't a full-on GC battle in the final climb, then it'll be a major disappointment. And it looks ugly. If you look it up online, it definitely looks ugly. And adding to ugly, Stage 19, Lourdes de Larons, 200-kilometer stage, first of all. And on top of that, I see some beyond category climbs on this. It looks really outrageous, and there's a long descent into Laurence at the end. Coming at the end of the third week, Stage 19 will be the final climbing stage of the 2018 Tour, and what a stage it is. Starting in Lourdes, the riders will then tackle the Col de Aspen, the Col de Tourmalet, and the Col de Aubisque. There is no summit finish, but instead a plunging descent from the top of Aubisque into the finish in Laurens, an exciting and frightening prospect in equal measure. And the last one that is on the list here would be Stage 20. We're just 2 days out, or 1 day out from the very end. And why? Because it is a time trial, and it's 31 kilometers. It's Saint-Pé-de-Nouvelle to Espelette, and it is hilly. It's got some real roller coasters on it, starting with a really serious climb at the beginning here. The only individual test against the clock in the 2018 race is left until the day before the end. Evidently, the organizers were happy with the way Stage 20 time trial panned out in the 2017 race and have replicated the formula. This one is far from straightforward, with a lumpy profile that will not necessarily favor outright power TT riders such as Tom Dumoulin. It will, however, favor defending champion Chris Froome, who will likely be satisfied with the route as a whole and will have his eye on his fifth Tour victory. So there you have it, folks. A little bit of a cap on what's going on with the Tour de France. We will be updating you on this as we go along. And, I hope you stay tuned with us and you can add some of your own feedback in here. It's an exciting time. And I'm going to move on to some upcoming events that are happening fairly locally here in northeastern Connecticut and southern Massachusetts. We have the Ride Around the Quabbin, which is coming up on Saturday, June 16th.
I'm going.
And you're going.
Yeah, I'm just going to do the metric.
And your old pal, Franny, will be there. That's a good thing.
Yes.
I will not. I have to work. So anyway, no big deal. But it's King's Tour of the Quabbin, 62, 100, and 125-mile rides from Rutland, Massachusetts, around the Quabbin Reservoir, a pristine jewel in the heart of Massachusetts. The Seven Lakes Ride is coming up on June 24th, 2018, our friends at Nearac Earth. It begins and ends at Stafford High School in Stafford Springs, Connecticut. There's a 62, a 45, a 25, and a 20-mile ride. It is a rain or shine event. The Thread City Century Ride, Saturday, July 28th, starting from Garrison Park in Chaplin, Connecticut. This is also following that one on Saturday, August 18th, the Steeplechase Bicycle Tour, near and dear to our hearts, been around for a long time, and we have a number of things going on there, including 100-mile rides, 100-kilometer rides, 50-mile rides, 35-mile rides, 20-mile rides, and even a 5-mile walk ride. And, of course, if you're interested in bicycle racing in New England, you want to visit bikeredge.com. My name is Peddlin' Ron. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you've been listening to this live or on podcast, you can contact me by sending me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to more and past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show or be on the show as a guest, please send an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Peddlin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs.